everybody. Welcome to the Tech Rapid Podcast. I'm Robert Scarpinito, your features editor.
Andrew Rutten, editor-in-chief.
Rutledge Doggett, site founder, and I would rather be in the bayou right now.
Why?
So, as I've talked about, I've had my soapbox a couple times on this podcast about Hunt Showdown, and they did it again. So they launched a new event this week that is actually really freaking cool. Like a giant alligator that you can fight in the bayou. And, like there's some thunderstorm elements and they brought like a ton of new environmental stuff in. I've been playing Hunt Showdown since before launch in duos for over 800 hours. And they're not letting duos in to the event. So the only way that you can play this event is in trios and
get some more friends.
So if you're a solo player, you cannot do the event. If you are a duos player, I mean, you can go into trios, but you're immediately at a disadvantage. And so
good.
If anybody else is a Hunt Showdown player and you are listening to this podcast, I feel your pain.
These all sound like solvable problems. This sounds like a problem.
We'll put his personal email in the show notes if you want to just email him and be his friend.
Rutledge@techraptor.net if you're as mad as I am. Let's go.
Or his personal. We'll put his personal email down there too, so you can check that out.
Which one?
All of them.
I'll give you his physical address also.
And his social security number will be down there too.
He's got to play against NFL Blitz first. That's how he tests his Hunt Showdown partners. Yeah. Hence why you can only find one guy to play with him.
But we do have a special guest. If you're on YouTube, you are already seeing his face, his beautiful face, coming to us from New York, live from New York.
Hi, everyone.
It's Saturday morning.
I am Jocko Farina. I'm the tabletop editor here at Tech Raptor.
Right. Now, I have a question for you. As a tabletop, you deal with tabletops a lot. So in the video game world, levels are kind of like chapters in a video game. But for you, are they kind of like the tool that you use to measure like how flat a table is? Is that kind of what your space is about?
You should have workshopped that before we started fucking recording.
Hey, that's where you get levels from, at workshop. You know?
Yeah. You go to the workshop to get a level. Yeah, we have a lot of problems with like very slanted tables and pieces rolling off the table. And so,
don't you just shove stuff onto the lathe?
This is now a woodworking podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, let's get Nick Offerman on here.
That would be great.
That would actually be pretty awesome.
Right. But so we have our tabletop editor here. We know there's a lot of like big news in the gaming world right now, like the FTC and the old Microsoft thing. Like that's all.
Okay.
It's out there. We have some coverage on the site if you want to check it out. But this week we wanted to bring on Jocko here because we wanted to kind of get a snapshot of where tabletop is right now. Because, you know, I mean, we talk a lot about video games, but there's more to gaming out there than just controllers and screens, right? There's a lot of tabletop type of stuff going on. And we have Jocko here to kind of give us a lowdown of like what's going on.
Great. Yeah. There's a lot going on in tabletop right now. It's a pretty good time to jump in and chat. I'm going to cover a couple of topics today that I think are worth chatting about. But really the biggest news, the biggest new release, I guess, in the tabletop world comes from Warhammer 40,000. There's a new edition, Warhammer 40K 10th edition, just launched, and it launched with this big new set for the game that is massive. I mean, the box itself is massive. It's called Leviathan. And it's really sort of, this feels like a nice big leap in the rules from what we've previously played. Do any of you have like experience previously with Warhammer or played it at all or have sort of a gauge of that?
Not a ton. Don't like be assuming too much here.
I'm gonna quiz you. No.
I see it at Gen Con and I immediately get overwhelmed.
So it can feel overwhelming, and that is really the heart of what they wanted to address with 40K. Games Workshop, the company that makes Warhammer 40K, has sort of two mainline games. There's Warhammer Age of Sigmar, which used to be their fantasy game. So that's, you know, monsters and
people were really happy with the
things
change.
Like that. Yeah. But I love it. I love Age of Sigmar. And then 40K, obviously, is there far in the future, grim, dark, you know, in the future, there is only war, sci-fi war game. Yeah. These are large scale miniature games. And it's a really involved thing. They call it the hobby, basically, because there's like a hobby aspect and the gaming aspect.
Yeah. Right. Like, I've heard the term hobby grade game. Is that used a lot?
Yeah. With Warhammer? The kits that you need to build, the kits that you get. So this Leviathan box came with a stack, like a very, very large stack of plastic spoons. And all of those little dudes needed to be snipped and fit together.
Are they fitted ones? Because I know they've been making more of those that just kind of pop together. Or do you have to glue this? You should glue the popped ones together too, probably at some point, or do something.
But in what I think is the first big move toward making the game more approachable, which is, I think, sort of the thesis of 10th edition. Yeah. All of the pieces now are fit together, or what we call push fit. So you still need special scissors, special clippers to snip them from their sprues, but they click together now instead of needing glued with plastic glue.
Glued and then scraped to get the mold. Well, if you're going real crazy, scraping mold lines off and
I infuriate the war perfectionist community because I don't have time, right? We're really lucky to have a lot of review product coming in from Games Workshop. And it's a never ending, it's almost weekly. Dude. There's a never ending flow.
Yeah, one that just came out as of recording, just came out this morning.
As of recording, we just had a big review of four different huge box sets of Age of Sigmar miniatures. So I enrage the community, I think, because my stuff is not nicely clipped and my photos are just get it on the pit, proof of life, it exists.
Would you agree, the hobbyist side of the modeling and painting and stuff, that's bigger than the game, people playing the game probably, right?
I think it is. That there is, because it's sort of, to play the game, you have to do the hobby anyway, right?
Yes.
You can buy on eBay and things like that. You can buy pre-made armies, but really that doesn't happen a lot. And to actually field an army in a Warhammer tournament and an official tournament, it needs to be a tournament quality, which means that the miniature itself has to be painted with at least three different colors. Every miniature, and an army may have 200 miniatures, right? 100 to 200. Right. And the basis is...
Wait, does the third color give them power? Or is this is there a certain rule here that, why?
There's no... It's just they don't want people to spray paint their army blue and say, here's my army, it's ready to go.
That's pain. Right. I can't come in and just shit stomp somebody with a still gray army.
Nope. No.
Oh, that's
not officially. If you're going down to your local hobby shop, they're probably not going to give a shit.
Everybody's going to look at you funny, but
yeah. Believe it or not, all of my playtesting is just gray mess, across the table. But so I think yes, more people do the hobby because everyone has to build it and play it and paint it to play it. You don't have to paint it to play it with friends, but you have to at least build everything. But then I think more people collect and build and take a lot of time painting.
That's how my buddy is. He's way more into the hobby. He liked playing the game, but it's for me. I don't know. I kind of liked putting them together and gluing them together. It's a pretty zen thing. It's I really like Lego because it's I can zone out.
Yeah,
it takes my attention just enough to where I'm not thinking about extraneous whatever. And that's kind of how I felt putting them together. It's just I'm just doing the little piece at a time, doing this. It can be pretty relaxing.
As long as what you're watching is in English, you can pretty much watch a movie or a TV show or something
it's great for that.
And be building the minis. Well,
here's a question though. What would you say is more intensive, Gundam or this, Warhammer?
I don't have a lot of experience building Gundams, but I've seen, it looks like nasty. It looks like there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. With little panes of plastic and stuff. This is not like that. It's, your average model probably has 4 to 6 parts that need to be glued together.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Which multiplies, if you're building a whole army.
Yeah, if you're doing it 40 times on the same exact miniature, you're fucking it. Yeah. It does it. You're I don't care anymore.
I know our former tabletop editor, Travis, is super into the painting and stuff like that. He's got a whole setup, and
he's awesome.
And he'll just like DM and be like, "I spent 8 hours painting this," or something along those lines. I'm just like, "Damn, dude!"
That's wild.
He's super into it.
Well, so the, you know, the, you can build a lot of minis, but what is it that it's 10th edition now, right, for Warhammer? So what's the reason to go from, like, I've been playing 9th edition a lot, but here's the 10th one. What's why would I play that now?
It's a lot more. So they've got this line that's like very catchy, and I think actually does pretty much sum up what's going on, which is they say simplified, not simple, for the new rules. A lot of the rules have been streamlined. There's like a lot of phases in the game, right? There's the movement phase, there's the psychic phase, all this stuff, right? The shooting phase. And they've condensed some of that. So there's no longer a psychic phase that's folded into another phase. So there are some smart, I think really smart rules contraction. It's also displayed much more visually now. Before, you would have to sort of flip through your book to all of your different models in your army, and look across little, you know, columns.
Stat blocks.
Now they each have their own card, which has most of their abilities that you would need to know printed out on it. The cards are also available digitally.
There's isn't a big thing with this? They aren't the rule books for various armies. Aren't those? Am I wrong? Are they free now?
They're free. So every
which
single,
is fucking huge, because before it's huge. Like, hey, you have to, for each army, if you want to do something, it's like, here's another $30-$40
yeah,
per one.
So every army currently, and I don't know if this is going to be forever, right? But every single army, the data cards, they're called, which are their like stat sheets, you know, are available online on Games Workshop.
Thank God.
To check out. They will release what are called codexes, which is army books. So you've got the core rule book, and then every single army, and there's like, there's a ton. There's like more than, I think there's more than 20. Every single army has its own codex with its own rules. We review them all here somehow. But it's, you know, I think those will still come out. It's such a moneymaker for them. They
Games Workshop stopped making actions. Money.
Yeah, they can't.
I didn't know they had that reputation.
And it'll have more rules and things like that.
So if I wanted to go out right now and you're like, okay, I want to invest, I want to learn Warhammer 40K, how much do you think that would cost? And is it one of these things where it's like, I just buy one army and I can figure it out? Or is there like a starter set or multiple armies?
That's such a good question. I think that Leviathan is your best bet, probably the box set. That is MSRPing for around like $215. So it's, you know, not a light investment, but that has the beginnings of two different armies. So what most people do is they'll start with a starter set, split it with a friend, and say, okay, you take this, I'll take that. This Leviathan set contains obviously Space Marines, who are sort of the poster children of Warhammer 40K, and Tyranids, which is really interesting to me that they chose that as like the baddies in this box, which are this race of sort of like alien bug dinosaurs. They're very cool. They're like the threat of the galaxy, because they come and they will devour a world and suck it of all of its like bioessence and then move on. And they're like fully organic, so all their guns are like woven into their bodies, and
they're very much the Zerg from StarCraft, if people played StarCraft. StarCraft and Warcraft just basically ripped off Warcraft or Warhammer completely. I mean, the Marines are literally just Space Marines. Zerg is Tyranids. Like, it's the same shit.
It's been around forever, so
yeah.
But I wonder if they're doing that with Tyranids, because the new Space Marine game, Space Marine 2, that's the big baddie there, is the Tyranids.
That is true.
They are good at synergy, so I would not be surprised.
I don't know.
They really.
I know that comes out this year, right? Something like that?
Yeah, the game, video games later this year. Yeah.
It's like October or something like that. Somewhere in Q3, Q4.
But so that's Warhammer 10th edition. Well, 40K 10th edition.
40K,
you have to make.
It's even more complicated, because aren't they doing like fantasy stuff again? Like they're going back to the classic Warhammer fantasy and like doing new things. Like before the end of the world, they're going back.
Yeah, it's called Warhammer the Old World.
That's right. That's
it's going to be Warhammer Fantasy on square bases. So now all of the bases for these miniatures are round, and they move sort of as a blob of units. Before, they were square. You kind of lock them all in together and move them as a whole unit. We call that rank and flank. Some war games that are pretty popular right now are still doing that, but it's sort of a little bit of a antiquated game design, or just very specific. It's a very war gamey way to play a game.
So I was only reason I brought that up because there's really like three different timelines of stuff that they're making now.
There's
the old world Sigmar, and then 40K. Well, then there's Horse Heresy stuff, which is also a different thing.
Which is like Warhammer 30K, takes place 10,000 years.
So actually, there's four things. But
and like Blood Bowl, we just reviewed. Their fantasy football game, which is
Then there's Necromunda and
The only stuff I understand about Warhammer is that I'll never understand Warhammer because it's I've heard it's so dense. The lore is so rad. Yeah. Well, it's rad, but also very dense that it makes like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings look like baby stuff.
The lore is nothing compared to that.
Yeah.
It really, it's wild. I mean, there are like 42 novels of varying quality, but, 42 novels that like just take place in the 10,000 years before, Warhammer 40K. I've read maybe 7 or 8 of them. One of our tabletop writers, Adam Potts, has like read them all. Like has the perfect angle to take to follow the novels.
Have all those novels, and with each like those codex and stuff aren't just simply rules. Like there's lore and like story and stuff. That's the important thing. They've been doing that since the beginning. Yeah. They've been writing story forever.
The codexes are about 50-50 an army's like life history, life story, and then the rules for the game.
Gotcha.
Anyway, 40K huge, Warhammer huge. Who 40K knew? Is huge.
But another thing that's huge is also Magic the Gathering and Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings also kind of huge. Despite recent ongoings with Lord of the Rings IPs. Yep. But there's that new Magic the Gathering set that is Lord of the Rings, right?
That's right. So there's a new Magic Gathering set. It's called, it's a Universes Beyond set, which I'll explain what that means in just a moment. But it's called, Lord of the Rings Tales of Middle-earth. And it is a Magic Gathering set featuring all Lord of the Rings characters, settings, monsters, adversaries. It's cool. These Universes Beyond sets are they've done one for like Transformers in the past and Warhammer.
I'll say they did Warhammer, right? Yeah.
In the past, where they'll take a beloved IP and build sort of a mini set around it.
Mm-hmm. They did one for Street Fighter as well, right? Or like I know they released Street Fighter cards.
So that was a Secret Lair drop. There are two different things. Universes Beyond or Secret Lair is here's a set of 6 cards and Ryu's on it. Here you go. Whereas Universes Beyond is a full playable, draftable magic set. And so this, there are new cards that are added to this that are legal in certain formats. So you can have Frodo in your modern deck if you want to, which is a format of the game. Right. There are some reskins. Some cards get a new name, but it's the same card with the same ability. And then there are some old cards that just make sense, right? If there's like a card that's like a, Haunted Forest, that's not an actual example, but if there's a card that's like a Haunted Forest and that makes sense in this fantasy world, then they'll put that in.
Yeah.
The big news around this was, the little bit of tricky marketing, but the stunt that they did with this, which is that they created a card that was a one of one printing of the One Ring.
The one to rule them all?
The one to rule them all, yeah, and in the darkness bind them. So it's there's one card, it was recently found, but it was hiding in one of these collector's packs. People were putting out, there was a bounty out for it for, what was it?
Highest I saw was 2 million, I think.
2 million.
What?
Someone was willing, supposedly they said out there they were willing to pay $2 million to whoever found this card.
Jeez. And that was like,
didn't the Black company, Lotus right? go for like yeah. $1 million about? A while back, I know it sold for a. Yeah. There was one. Was there was one that was like really highly graded that sold for a boatload, but I don't think it even touches this bounty.
No, this one's wild.
And this is, I mean,
and that's, you know, like some exec at Wizards is like, oh, I got one in my office. Like, yeah, exactly. 101 my ass. No,
540k was the Black last. The most expensive sold Black Lotus was 540k. Yeah.
But who knows? So you're times that. It's not as precious as the One Ring.
No.
Facts.
Exactly. And that makes sense, right? I mean, Black Lotus is a very rare card. It's a very playable, powerful card as well, which sort of helps it. The One Ring is great, but it's, I mean, the Black Lotus is the Black Lotus because it's just a very, very, very powerful card. It was only in original sets. It's part of what's called the Power 9, which is a series of cards that they promised would never be reprinted to retain their value. And there are, you know, a few of the, nine of these different cards, and early printings of these cards fetch, like 500K. It's a big deal. So, it's terrifying to me to own anything that I don't know. Yeah. I can never get in the mindset of a super. Well, it always
reminds me, like, you see someone that's like, let's say like Antiques Roadshow or something. They're like, that's worth $500,000. Like, fuck. And then these people are always like, yeah, this is like a liability to them now. Like, that's why they got to sell it. Like, it's it's a problem.
Yeah, if I found out something I owned was worth $500,000, I would say, okay, please buy it. Like,
get it off my hands. Yeah,
get it away from me. Now I don't want to touch it.
I'll be so stressed about having it. Yeah.
And you know my Cheeto habit, the dust would be everywhere. So.
Oh, yeah. That would degrade it down to like $500 instead of $500.
I don't know. Yeah. Jocko Cheeto dust might raise the value.
That might, yeah.
For certain connoisseurs.
Individuals.
Yeah. But for all intents and purposes, this is still like a Magic set, right? You can buy these cards and play the game Magic the Gathering because it's not like.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's not like special rules. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a full set of cards for it. You can play on MTG Arena, which is the digital version of the game. And you can buy packs. You can buy collector's packs now. I think those prices should probably be dropping. The prices of the collector packs, which held the One Ring, were like just steeply, steeply climbing as people were fishing for the ring. There are still very valuable cards in the collector's packs. They did that. So they did the limited run, the one of one ring. They did another fun thing, which is like they made 900 versions of the like 9 rings for men or dwarves. I forget. I should know this for men. And you know, like 700 of the dwarven ring, like things like that make sense with the number. So it's still super limited, still super valuable.
Right.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
But so in terms of like, because I know in Magic, there's like the Planeswalkers, right? Like those are like really powerful cards of like a hero or like a major character in the Magic the Gathering universe. Do they do that with Lord of the Rings here, where you can play as like Frodo or Boromir, Aragorn?
Yes, absolutely. And those are like not Planeswalkers specifically, which is like a type of card that is, you know, has a very specific role in the game. But they're just sort of legendary heroes. So you can play as different versions too. Some of them have different titles. So there's like Frodo, Sauron's Bane, and then like a different version of Frodo. There's a card that is Aragorn and Arwen, wed. And it's a picture of them, you know, on their wedding day, and that confers different bonuses.
Well, spoilers.
Sorry.
I have that card right here.
You haven't read the appendix yet, then this is going to be a spoiler. And that's actually a point that I wanted to get to, speaking of the appendix. This is definitely like book inspired, which is really cool. I opened two different foil Tom Bombadils in the process of opening packs for review. There's a lot of stuff that's only in the books. We have an article up on the site, in fact, if you'd like to read about sort of the deep lore cuts that were included in the Lord of the Rings MTG set.
And that's at techraptor.net.
Exactly. Click tabletop.
Techraptor.
Yeah.
Run right to tabletop.
Right along the top there. But yeah, I mean, top this is pretty cool because, like, you know, I mean, you think of like Magic the Gathering is pretty big in the tabletop space. Like, it's the collector trading card game, right? Like, it's the one for it. And Lord of the Rings is very mainstream. Like, as far as fantasy properties go, it's pretty mainstream. Well, okay, yeah. Pokemon, yeah. But nobody plays Pokemon. They just collect the cards. Yeah. But yeah, but like Lord of the Rings is a very popular, like, mainstream. Like, there's a lot of people out there who probably like Lord of the Rings that have never touched a Magic card, you know? So I'd be curious to see how many of them would be
it
like.
It made me more interested. Mm-hmm. I was always casually like, maybe I'll play it. I was like, oh shit, I'd play some Lord of the Rings cards.
Mm-hmm. And you tried out, you tried the set out,
I
did. Right?
I played the game. I have played it. Mm-hmm. I like the theming of it. It does, I wish I could remember all the mechanics because it's like you get, if you haven't seen them and now you see it once, you get bombarded with so many cards. But they all, I remember remarking like, oh, these all like, they're all pretty clever to the character or the idea that they're conveying. Like, I'm trying to remember, like, what we had Gollum out and he played Gandalf. I wish I could remember what Gandalf did. He was a fucker, though. Like, he was like, God damn it. Like, once he played it, we're like, we're so screwed. Like, as soon as I saw him pop out, I was like, dude, we don't have anything. Because I was playing with another guy, another journalist against one of the, devs, I don't know, of Wizards people. And we just got our shit rocked by it. But, it was fun. I really liked all that was going on. I think they did make me interested in, to the point of I pre-ordered the starter set, and then they were nice enough to just send it to me, so I canceled my pre-order.
Oh, because
it was the same exact thing. I just got the same thing.
Right.
I really love that starter set. To talk about theming, there are cards in the deck that create tokens that you can use to, yeah, you know, sort of just a floating thing that's you can use for various effects. And there's things that create a food token, right? That's really big with the hobbits. So it's really fun that the hobbits are creating lots of food tokens. The token is something that you can sort of trash in the game to give yourself 3 life. The enemy side of the starter deck, the Sauron side, also creates food tokens. One of the cards creates food tokens. And the tokens that are included for the hobbits, it's like a bunch of cheese and meat and what you'd expect. The food tokens on the evil side is a human wrapped up in spider webs, like completely
delicious.
Cocooned.
It's good stuff. Really
nice, really, and crispy, fun, you know? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. There's that kind of stuff in, like, card where you get a mass army of orcs or goblins stuff too. And people that, like, played into that. It was pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it almost makes me want to, like,
job. A lot of love. A lot of love, clearly.
Yeah, the art's great. I mean, art's kind of always great in Magic cards, honestly. But
yeah.
Yeah, like, I remember I got into that one Magic set that was, like, Cyberpunk
those
recently.
Those are some pretty rad art.
Those are some really cool ones. And I love that each booster, I don't know if they still do it, but it, like, you know, you get the normal card, like, the cards that come in it. But then there's just, like, one card that's just, like, a pure art print, like, no borders, no anything. It's, like, sweet. You can't play it, obviously. It's, like, it's just to collect the art. But it's, like, that's pretty cool that they do that. Mm-hmm. The last thing here on this little snapshot of tabletop we've got here is Gloomhaven. We've talked about Frosthaven before on the podcast, with Stretch, who's played it, which Frosthaven's kind of like the sequel?
Yeah.
Spiritual successor to Gloomhaven. But Gloomhaven is this very popular, I mean, we're talking fantasy RPGs here, right? It's a very popular tabletop game as well.
Super So the news here basically is that Gloomhaven has a new RPG. The game itself is a very tactical, big, sprawling board game, which you've all talked about before. Lots and lots of hours can be sunk into the game.
Oh, yeah.
It's a campaign game, both Gloom and Frosthaven, where you'll be, you know, you'll play an adventure and then you'll unlock new things at the town, at your home base, and or unlock new characters that are literally hidden in tuck boxes that you can't look at until you get to them. It's really cool. Now they're releasing a new role-playing game with tons and tons of miniatures. And the real news here is that everything they do is gold. I mean, they just, like, they can't not make money. It's really shocking. It's, and they're a great company. Like, this is not like, they just keep making money. They're great. The guy, Isaac Childress, who runs this, who basically made Gloomhaven all on his own, from his own brain, this massive, you know, 100-hour board game, created this company, and they just keep creating things, and the community is just always there for them. They have a new thing on Backer Kit, which is like a sort of like a Kickstarter, where you can pledge for, you know, for all this different stuff, the second edition of Gloomhaven, but really the RPG and the minis. And they're already at 2.6 million. That's like nothing for them though, which is the wild thing. So I did a little look, you know, I wanted to talk through their crowdfunding expertise basically. And it's like the first Gloomhaven printing, the first time it hit Kickstarter, it raised over 300K. And that was considered like unfathomable for the board game industry, right? Then they did a second printing of Gloomhaven, and that hit 3.9 million on Kickstarter.
I remember that.
And that was wild. Yeah. And then they did Frosthaven, and that raised $12 million on Kickstarter. So these guys,
that's crazy.
So they're, you know, they're almost at 3 million. They've got 18 days left to go at the time of this recording. They just keep, it's shocking.
Mm. Yeah. Gloomhaven is one of those where it's like, I did get Jaws of the Lion. That's like a smaller, more compact thing. You know, I live in Seattle, right. Rent's expensive. So for me, the more expensive part of Gloomhaven isn't the box, but more the table and rent I would need to then play what's in the box, you know? So that's why it's been hard for me to want to invest in Gloomhaven fully. You see
that little table next to him? That's his bed.
That's where I sleep. Wow, yeah, right there. Yeah.
That's good for your back. That's good.
It is, yeah. But what I have played of Jaws of the Lion, I can really see why, like, this is something that really hits people pretty well. Because, like, it is an RPG, but it doesn't, like, you look at it from the outside and you're like, oh, this kind of looks like D&D. But they do enough in Gloomhaven that it feels different enough that there's a unique mechanic there, you know, like there's that like the two-sided or like the top and bottom cards, you know, where there's like the strategy of like it's random, but also you kind of get a choice, which feels kind of nice compared to D&D where it's like you roll dice and like that's it. You're kind of stuck with what you got, right?
Totally. There's a lot of mechanics going on in Gloomhaven. To very, very top line summarize it, you're, you know, moving people around a board, attacking with your character, fighting enemies, but everything is done with a deck of cards, so you're not rolling dice at all. And you're drawing cards, and yeah, as you were saying, there's a top and a bottom to each card, and the top has one ability and the bottom has another, and you have to choose one. And some of the abilities are really powerful, but then you have to remove them from not even your discard, from outside of the game for the length of that encounter. And if you run out of cards, that's your health, basically, or that is a way that you can be defeated. It's basically your stamina. And so it's a really tense push and pull. A lot of people bounce off of it because of that. But there's a lot, there are also obviously millions of people, you know, thousands of people do not bounce off of that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I'd be curious to see where their new backer kit that backer kit goes in terms of how much they raise by the time, what is it, 18 days from now? So like about 16 days from when this episode goes live, we'll see where it's at,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's enough of a snapshot of the tabletop industry. What have you been playing though, Jacko?
Okay, so I've been playing, it's not the newest game, but this sort of current obsession in our house. We play a lot of games. My wife is sort of my not unhappy participant, but like we have to play a lot of board games for the level of reviews.
Too much ice cream.
She sees the box come in and she's like, oh God, here we go. God.
I mean, yes, the piles and piles and piles. Though, I mean, she loves board games as well. And we've been playing, and when we find one that we both are like really, really into, to the point that like other games that need to be reviewed aren't getting played, that's when I know that something's really special. And we've been playing Catan, Dawn of Humankind. This is, I'm working on my review right now for this. It's a little bit older. It came out last year, but it's a really brilliant evolution of Settlers of Catan. In this, you play as it's like the dawn of humanity. So you play basically as cavemen making your way from sort of Africa through the rest of the world. And you're still trading resources. You're still doing the basic things that you do in a game of Settlers of Catan. But there's much more sort of action variability. It's a much less confined board game space. And it's just, I can't recommend it enough. It's a re-implementation of a game called like Stone Age Catan or something, like Settlers of the Stone Age. But apparently the art from that, this was from 2002. Apparently the art is bad in the old version, and the rules were a little clunky. But this is really fun. You're gathering resources like stone and bone and hide, and you're using that to sort of upgrade your people's culture. So you may want to, you know, get, if you upgrade so that you get footwear that helps you move further on the map, you know, because your people are learning to make footwear, or you're learning to make a boat, and so then you can go to Australia.
This is like the world map.
It's the world map. Yeah. Huh. It's the like Paleolithic world map.
It's huge. Building settlement, there's not like settlement thing or like roads that you're doing and like rolling to get resources or.
So they've, that's a great question. They've removed roads, obviously. Yeah. You have two different types of tokens now. You have a settlement token that's sort of like a camp that you set up, and you have a sort of a explorer token that is a little token of a caveman and woman and a cave baby. And you're moving your explorers along the map. And then when you get to a place, a campsite that has an abundance of food with these little food tokens, that's enough for you to set up camp. And then if you pay the resources that you need, you can take the food token, which scores you a point.
So this is Civilization, the board game.
It's a mix between Settlers and a Civ game for sure. Because you've got tech tracks, basically, right? You're like, it's pretty cool. Dude.
Okay, this does sound
I might like order it now.
Yeah, it's really good.
This sounds pretty rad.
Because I love Civ. I'm so bad at it, but I still love playing Civ.
And Civ's great.
Yeah, it's so good. So like this, because I also like, I like Settlers of Catan too. I feel like it's one of the, it's like the next board game after Monopoly that people learn.
Yeah, like you know what I mean? People like start to like, what is board gaming about? That's the game that people 100%. Start with.
100%. It's either that or Ticket to Ride. That this is like Settlers plus Civ, I'm like,
that's pretty cool.
And it's kind of like baby's first Civ in a good way. You know what I mean? It's not overwhelming. You have four different tech trees you can grow on, and it's very clear why you need to do them and how they're helpful. And first person to 10 points wins. And so it's a very, you know, once you learn the rules, it's about an hour 15 to play with. Like, we played with three people a few times.
Not bad.
Yeah. Mm.
Hell yeah. That What's the max number of players in one?
Settlers always is weird. And I think it's such a ubiquitous game that it's funny that it has this restriction. It's for three or four players only.
Okay.
So you can't play with more. You can't play with two.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Well, that's Catan, Dawn of Humankind.
Yep.
Will be on Andrew's shelf in the next week or so. So we can hear about it from them next week. Rut, you've been playing, to jump into video games now, you've been playing Dave the Diver.
Yeah, this is one that I'm gonna say Evolve PR, I'm very sorry, I've been getting emails for months. It was in early access and it just went 1.0 this week, and it has like taken the industry by storm. Like, it is all over my Twitter feed, it is everywhere. It went from having like a couple hundred people playing a day to there are like 50, almost 40,000 people playing right now. And it's an indie game where you are opening a sushi restaurant next to this like lagoon that changes every day. And so you have all these fish and you're a diver, and they have like some different components to it where like you can go diving and you can catch fish that you then turn into sushi to make money, to hire staff, so on and so forth. So there's a little bit of kind of like a shop management type vibe, but also exploration. But then they've thrown in some other things where you have a cell phone and your goal is to essentially level up your restaurant on what is basically Instagram for restaurants, called Cooksta, and you can like upgrade your diving gear. You get guns, underwater guns, which is, I don't think bullets actually work underwater, but we'll leave it.
Yeah, there's harpoon guns.
To get the fish? You shoot the fish?
You shoot the fish dead.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you use a net gun and catch them, they're worth more. It's like a risk reward. Yeah,
you don't damage the fish. You gotta keep the quality. You
blow the fish head off.
It's like when people hunt, you can't shoot in the wrong place. You'll fuck the meat up.
Yeah. But there's like an underwater civilization that like you're finding clues to as you're fishing and catching things. And this giant like, there's like a giant monster that lives there. So there's like this whole kind of mystery behind you just trying to run a sushi restaurant as well. But it's super chill vibes. Mysterious. It's super chill vibes. Just a great little soundtrack that goes along with each aspect.
Dude, this game sounds fucking weird, but I'm like on board.
Okay, so when you upgrade, so if you catch a bunch of fish, you can upgrade the sushi, like the roll that you're making essentially. And every time you do that, a cutscene plays of the chef just doing some real anime shit. Like there's one where he like chops the head off the fish and then it zooms into the aquarium behind him with a fish like wide eyed open. And that one's my favorite, but there's like a bunch where he's like throwing it up in the air and then cutting it with a sword. And it's pretty goofy. So it's like, it's very light, a lot of humor. But it was one that like, I was like, oh, that looks neat. I'll get to it later. And then everybody started talking about it and I was like, fuck, this looks dope. And I feel really bad about missing it.
Wait, so is it still in early access right now? Or is it?
It is 1.0 now. Yeah, it's been early access for, I want to say, a couple months, if I remember correctly. But yeah, it went 1.0 on like a week and a half ago.
Everything sounds great about it, except your recommendation.
Classic.
That kind of.
It's on sale right now.
For me.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is the Steam sale right now, isn't it?
It is.
Steam Open your wallets.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a game that'll never go on sale. Zelda Tears of the Kingdom.
Bring it to tears.
Jocko on the pod,
has some things he wants to say.
Yeah, we've been pretty glowing about that game.
We want you to know these are his individual opinions and not the expressed opinions of TechCrunch.
Thank you for the tee up.
Mid-podcast Twitter bio.
Yeah. So, first off, this is like the most tabletop thing of me to come in, like a month and a half later and say, have you guys tried this Zelda game? Like, obviously.
I feel like always Fortnite. So,
have you heard about Fortnite?
No,
you can be Goku against Darth Vader with Indiana Jones with them.
I'm very interested in that. I've been playing Tears of the Kingdom. I love Breath of the Wild. Tears of the Kingdom is not fun. I mean, I get that it's beautiful, it's brilliant. This game, I'm sorry, this game is a slog. I've heard y'all talking about how this is Game of the Year contender. It's Game of the Year contender if the other game options were like reading the Bible start to finish and doing the dishes. Like those are like, yeah, then it's more fun than that. But I can't climb up these walls one more time. I can't build another like wheeled contraption that lasts 30 seconds. I know I'm not upgrading the material and stuff, but I feel like I can't move like 10 feet on the map without getting like completely destroyed or completely lost. And there's something about it. I don't know. Maybe it's too big. Maybe it's like too big of a game for me. And Breath of the Wild was like the right amount of big. But it's not clicking, and I don't know what's wrong with me. But I also don't get the I don't know.
But how do you feel about you take rock, you take stick, put rock on stick?
Yeah, you just described a caveman game to us, and you don't like this. Like ooga booga, let's go.
If you don't even like the fuse mechanic, then yeah, I can see why it's.
Oh boy, because yeah, I'm with you kind of on the building stuff. I'm like, if they force me to do it, I guess I'll do it. But largely, I don't give a shit. I'm not doing it. There's so much other cool stuff going on.
I just want to use a sword with my cool shield and I want to kill things and I don't want to need to have like a giant tooth attached to it. Like I like the, I think it's like an aesthetic thing for me. I like the aesthetic of like Zelda with his like little sword and his little shield and his little hat running around. And yeah, there's something Zelda about it that. For me that's like,
I don't remember him having a hat in goofy. Breath of the Wild.
He doesn't have a hat, does he? He might have a little blue
no,
hat.
No, but you can put a you can put a hat on him though.
You can put a hat on him.
You can put a hat on him here.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good point. I didn't also I didn't realize how important the fuse mechanic was for like 3 hours. So I was like, oh, that's a cool thing you can do, I guess. This is dumb, whatever. So I'm like fighting, getting destroyed, and I'm like, what is the problem here? And why are all of my weapons like a strength 4? Mm-hmm. And so I realized that that helped, but it's just I've felt so frustrated, right? Like I felt so like I can't make any progress. This is stressing me out. That I hadn't played it before, but I got the this is again so tabletop of me. The Bowser's Fury, the Mario, you know, and I'm playing that for the first time, and I'm like, yeah, I can get all 3 green stars in every level. Like, I mean, that's progress, baby.
That game also fucking slaps. That like, game that game is yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, it's really it's yeah. good stuff.
I will say, yeah. I've been avoiding Zelda because of how much there is to do, and I get like paralysis because I have this weird. Fucked up part of my head that has to do everything. And so I'm looking at but I've looked at both Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom like I don't know if this will be healthy for me.
No,
and that's my worry.
Tears, I'm with you because I get the I usually like games a little more direction given to me, but with Tears of the Kingdom it gives you enough hints of like here's some cool shit over here if you want to. And if you let go of like whatever and just run around and be like, hey, that look, what's going on over there? And like, oh, that was cool. Oh, what's going on over there? Like, there's enough of that that it's like, oh, okay, that can stream you along well enough. But I get what you're saying. I understand the point.
I think another thing for me, not to dunk too hard, because obviously everyone loves it.
You gave it a 10, right? Or a 9.5.
We gave it a 10.
I think we gave it a 10.
Yeah, we gave it a 10.
Yeah.
No one asked me, I guess. Because I hadn't played it yet, because I'm in tabletop.
One of our few 10s.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that for me what's hard is that it does have that, like, you can go, you can climb on those mountains, right? The classic thing. But nothing feels super, and maybe this is because I also devoured Breath of the Wild, but nothing feels super, super surprising once you get down onto the main world for me. I haven't discovered anything that I'm like, whoa, that changes how I play the game, that really mixes things up. It's like you'll do all of this stuff and find this really cool spot, and there's like 10 arrows waiting for you, right? So I feel like I like games. The new Jedi Survivor game was doing that for me, where you really go out of your way and you find stuff that, like, it seems like really changing the way you're playing the game, or at least the way you look.
I guess,
you know,
that's an interesting way to think about it, because it's what you're getting in a Tears of the Kingdom. If you're looking like, oh, I need it, or not I need, but like I enjoy getting the new thing to do. What I find really cool about Tears of the Kingdom is that what the reward you get is an interesting way that they play with the system in the game. Like something with the shrine or something like that. That like they do something that's interaction where you're like, oh, that was actually really clever. And it's usually like when you wrap your head around why they were doing what they were doing with the mechanic, you're like, oh shit, that was actually pretty cool. So that's the kind of stuff that I find that I'm like, that's really cool that they did that.
I get that. So the reward is more experience. The experience like, of playing it. Like it's an honor to be nominated.
Yeah, well, it's the hippie way of thinking of it, but honestly, it's the journey, not the destination with Tears of the Kingdom. Like, I finished I shouldn't say finished. I beat the main story. I've rolled credits. I still am like 30% of the game. Of what I've seen,
there's
maybe
so much of the game.
I mean, I think I've found over 110 shrines, but like barely the depths. Like, I spent some time last night discovering more of the depths, and I found some stuff where I was like, that's cool that's there. I never would, like, it was unexpected. Like, in this 100 plus hours I've been in here, I was not expecting to see something like this in the depths, which is cool. I didn't do anything with the thing I found because I didn't feel compelled to, because I've already got kind of everything, you know? So I think that's kind of the struggle where I'm at now. And maybe like now I'm not saying I agree 100% with you, Jocko, but I'm at the point where I'm like, I can see where you're coming from with that. Cause I think I've hit the point where like, if I keep going over this hill, I will get to where you are.
This is this reminds me, this is pretty similar. Cause I think that, I talked about some, I think when the first time we talked about Tears of the Kingdom, I think that the way that Tears has been going is a almost, no, not the same, but it's a very, very similar design philosophy to like Super Mario Odyssey. Where it's like, we're just going to give you a ton of shit to do, a ton of mechanics, a ton of things. Go wild. Do whatever you want to do. Do whatever order. Find whatever. And one of the common criticisms that people have with Odyssey later on is like, usually it's people that, you know, they found a few hundred moons and, you know, there's like 700 of the fuckers or something like that. They're like, oh, not all of them are engaging or whatever. Or like, I don't feel as rewarded now that, you know, I've unlocked everything. It's probably like fucking duh. Like, the point of it is to put enough in enough places that, oh, if this player didn't think to look here, but this player thought to look here, that person's getting it. Like, the point isn't to be a completion, and that was breaking people's brains, I think. Right. But, like, I need to get all of them, and, like, but all of them aren't good. It's like, well, yeah, like, because there's 700 or whatever. Like, they're not going to be. Yeah. But it's an interesting design thing where, like, it rewards any style of player, any, like, Any order that I want to do something, wherever I'm discovering, wherever I'm exploring this, like really, two people's playing is going to be extremely different because we're going to find different things and we might not find the same thing. Like I might experience something you didn't, and that kind of thing. So I think that's the tact that they've been taking with their bigger games lately. I love it because like that feeling of constantly finding new and cool shit in Odyssey was one of the best. That was one of our other tens we've ever given was Odyssey. Right. And I get that same vibe with Tears.
So I think my problem is that I'm a baby and a board gamer because I would give Odyssey a 10 as well. Because it's fantastic. Easy. Like, it's just like I think also like Tears of the Kingdom is not
an easy game.
If you
started fusing shit together, it'd be a little easier.
Okay,
for
maybe
you.
If I start using my teeth. I got 100 teeth. I got to start attaching these sticks now.
Yeah, exactly. throw them on your arrows too. It's helpful.
There you go. Yeah.
But
well, I feel a lot better now.
No, I can see why someone would bounce off. Like, man, this isn't as much for me. Because I think it's a similar thing that people ran into with even with Breath of the Wild, where like people talking about the durability or the lack of direction and that kind of stuff. And there wasn't much of not that Zelda's really known for a story anyway, but like not much of that going on. Like it's that, but tuned up a notch. But I'd say they give you a lot more to engage with in Tears than in Breath of the Wild.
Story-wise,
whether you
agree,
like it
100%.
Or not,
I like the story.
Yeah, there's a lot
story's
more story
cool stuff.
To
it's probably the
into.
Cool story. Well, one of the cooler stories in a Zelda game, at least a mainline Zelda game, because a lot of them don't feature much.
Yeah, well, because see, I've always felt that the fuse mechanic it fixes the problem of durability, because I know durability was a big problem people had with the first game. But I guess I didn't think that it also replaces the durability problem with a fuse problem now, where it's like you do have to think about, what are you going to fuse it with? And my answer was always, I never updated the game. I still haven't updated the game. So I'm just going to like duplicate a bunch of white Lionel horns and throw them on my swords.
You cheater.
Yeah.
This is fucking Kitten's game all over again.
It's Kitten's game all over again.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
But
deep podcast lore.
Obviously, though, it's like duplicating isn't a core. It's not meant to be the way to play the game. So I am... You know, skirting around.
Were you
the
kid duping rare candies back in the day, you son of a bitch?
No, I never figured out a rare candy dupe.
Oh, well then you didn't really actually play Pokemon then.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Because the game's notoriously so hard that you need a rare candy dupe in Pokemon.
I got places to be, classes to skip, homework to not do. Man, I can't get everybody to 100 by fighting Pokemon.
See, that was World of Warcraft for me.
Fair. But okay, we found the one of maybe four people in the world that do not like Tears of the Kingdom.
You are the Tobias Fuke.
Yeah.
You are the never nude of Tears of the Kingdom.
There are dozens of you.
Yeah.
We got one more game to talk about here. Just a quick little check-in on Final Fantasy 16, because Andrew, you wanted to talk about Clive and his big sword.
I mean, it's pretty average. In this world.
Fair.
I wouldn't say he's, you know, it's not crazy. Although he gets a lot of them. There's a lot of swords. You're burning through swords pretty quickly in this game.
Yeah.
Boy. Final Fantasy 16, huh?
And that's all the time we have for today.
I don't know. I feel like people that like are criticize it are like getting like fucking bombed hard. Like people are going at them. Like, how dare you? A lot of times.
Are you about to get bombed hard? Is that what you're?
So I will start with this. It had one of the coolest sequences in a game I think I've ever done, period. Like, really fucking cool. And then there's a bunch of filler bullshit that I fucking hate in between it. Mm-hmm. Every time I come up to a normal pack of mobs, I'm like, hey, fucking hit the thing, do my thing, all right, let's fucking move. Let's get a move on. None of these are interesting. You stand there, they stand there, they don't fucking do anything. I'm just spamming buttons. They're boring. This feels like, well, like Rhett will understand more of this, but it's definitely, you can feel the MMO design of this. Like, oh, these are the trash mobs that nobody fucking cares about. They're filler nonsense until I can get to the cool shit.
Gotta get you 20 wolf pelts.
That are the boss fights. Yeah, and the crafting is stupid. The gear upgrades is fucking stupid. The ability points are stupid. All that's bad. All of it's terrible. They could cut out half of this game and it would be an amazing game. Get rid of all the open world stuff. I hate running through the world. Every side quest fucking is garbage. It's some of the worst side quests I've ever seen in a game. They're terrible.
I've seen people talk about how they like them.
Yeah, I have a chocobo. Who gives a shit? it lets me get somewhere quicker so I don't have to sit through all the bullshit anymore. And I feel compelled because games have like conditioned me to do their god-awful side quests. Like, I do them all. It's massacre. I don't know why I do it. It's sadism.
Unless it's Crisis Core.
What am I doing? Oh, fuck Crisis Core. this would be Crisis Core if it didn't have the cool bosses. Just saying.
Oh.
Just saying.
I wouldn't go that far.
I don't think, okay, that's a little mean. The writing's not as bad as Crisis Core. Crisis Core is dog shit. But
Gungaga.
The story, I'm still like, I don't know about this, guys. People are like, hey, it's Game of Thrones inspired. I'm like, I mean, I guess there's multiple kingdoms. I guess. I don't know. It doesn't feel very Game of Thrones-y to me. I can see the moments where they're trying to be like, ah, this would fit in Game of Thrones. It's like, yeah, maybe if you had a little fucking nuance and built up to that moment, you fuckhead. But anyway. But with all that said, the boss fights, the icon, they're so rad. They're so fucking cool that I don't care. I will eat all this garbage so I can get to the filet mignon at the end,
right?
Because it's so good. I can't wait for the next boss thing. I don't know what it is, don't care. I do listen to all the stuff about the story. I don't really give a shit, but I cannot wait to fight the next guy.
See, I can't remember if I said this on the pod last week or it was in one of our Slack chats, but I compared this game to Asura's Wrath at one point, jokingly at first, but the more I play it, the more I'm kind of like, well, a little bit.
Yeah.
Because Asura's Wrath is, it's a very, like, when it's cool, it's very fucking cool, right? Yeah. Like, you're doing some, like, you're a dude who spawns six arms and punches a god who tries to, like, squish you with a finger.
That's
on the planet.
Cool shit.
And you're just punching the big ass finger like up. It's great.
That's cool shit.
And that's cool shit. And that's the vibe I get with the when you play the big boss fights.
They deliver. Like, people were building up. I kept hearing like, oh, the Titan thing, it's gonna be really cool. And I was like, the other ones have been all right. They've been cool enough, I guess. Dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fucking cool. It is really good. Like, I was sitting there like I was like, oh, that was it. It's over. Nope. I was like, that was cool, but not that cool. And then it just kept going and getting fucking cooler and cooler. It's rad. I can see how they got, you can see the influence of the Nier and Kingdom Hearts teams more and more as I've played. I can see why they have how their combat teams were brought in. But I guess my feeling with Final Fantasy, it is one of the greatest games I've ever loved and hated. I love and hate it. It's a dichotomy. It's a paradoxical game of really bad game design, really old school game design, and really all of the same exact problems I had with 15, almost to a T, the exact same problems I had with 16. 16's just got a way fucking cooler gameplay. That's kind of it.
Yeah, because so far I'm feeling a lot of similar things you are, although I'm not as mad about the trash mobs because I like the combat enough where I'm like, the trash mobs
do anything.
But they don't do well, some of them try to, and then I just do it. Yeah,
but then you do
the same
combo again and again and again and again and again and again and again.
Maybe I haven't played as much. Well, because I haven't played as much.
That's true, you haven't played as much. So eventually you're going to be like, oh, hey, there's another fucking spawn of things I got to kill before I get to the cool thing.
Yeah, like where I'm at is
this mini boss I fought before. I can't wait to do that again.
Like I just got the third icon power set. So I'm still in that stage where I'm like trying to figure out how to use them. And like that's the puzzle in my brain that's fun to figure out is like, how do I use that icon effectively? Especially because the third one you get is really weird compared to the other two. The third one, Ramu. Yeah. That one's really weird compared to the others, I think. Yeah. Like the way their power works. So that's been fun to figure out.
You're talking about I don't know what they call it, like the circle thing.
Something justice or whatever.
Whatever the fuck they call them.
Yeah.
I don't care.
So that I'm having fun with, but I kind of agree with you that like the side quests, I'm mashing X through them.
I'm waiting. So everybody's like, oh, there's some cool story stuff going on. Like, I see what they're doing. There is a little bit of world building going on, but it's like, go to this guy, talk to this guy, run back to this guy, talk to this guy, now run back to this guy and talk to this guy. But wait a minute, there's this guy over here. Go talk to him, really, and then come back to me. And it's like, go fuck yourself, is what I want to tell you.
Yeah. Because I've played like 20 hours of Final Fantasy 14 trying to get through a Realm Reborn content because I was like, you know, everyone says the expansions are the cool shit, but I feel like I owe it to myself to play the base game first.
Almost played the whole base game, just fucking skip it.
Yeah, I kind of like if I go back, I would just skip it all. But I was definitely getting a lot of flashbacks to my experience with the Final Fantasy 14 base game playing this just in the way that the side quests are set up, which is and the world too. I feel like the world, it's like huge open maps that feel like MMO maps because it's
they're absolutely MMO maps.
Because there's like, oh, there's like that hidden alcove. Maybe if I go there, I'll get a cool, like maybe I'll get a Buster Sword or something. But like that doesn't matter if you get it. And two, like you're going to get like 10 wolf claws where you need 100 of them to upgrade one of your swords.
I've never once been like, oh, I don't have enough of the thing that I need. Mm-hmm. So what's the point?
Yeah, but I'm still on, like, I think that's the weird thing about this game though, right? It's like you said, like
fucking wait for the next boss fight. I don't care about all that stuff that I just hate. I just said I hated, like, I don't care. As long as I get to another Titan-like moment, I am more than satisfied with this. Because it is just spectacle to the highest degree. It's like, hey, what would be cool? Like, no, make it cooler. What would be epic? No, make it more epic. And just to insane degrees. It reminds me of, like, the first time playing 7, and you're fighting Sephiroth, One-Winged Angel's playing. Like, what's the fucking move that he does? Where it's like, it floats through space, it's destroying planets on its way to hit your party. And it's like 2-minute animation just to fucking hit your party. And you're like, this is so insanely cool. It's that to just a crazy level, crazy degree. It's great.
But you know, you brought up 15, and I think to an extent 7 remake as well, right? Well, 7 remake I liked overall more.
7 remake is good, a very different game design.
It is, but I'm thinking of 15, right? 15 had a similar problem of there's a lot of filler, but when it's epic, it's pretty fucking cool.
It is pretty epic. Yeah, I think the epic moments of 16 are way more epic.
I agree. But at least like that was the same thing with 15, right? Where it's like a lot of valleys, but then when it peaks, it really peaks. Like the Leviathan fight, fucking rad.
Pretty rad.
The final boss fight was pretty cool. It was basically Dragon Ball.
Oh, this is the Titan stuff and the other boss fights. You're playing Dragon Ball Z. Like the Dragon Ball Z games should be this cool. It's like, you fuckers, look at this. You put out one or two of them a year. Stop that. And spend enough time on making a really fucking cool one and look to 16 to do it. Because it's so crazy. Spectacle. Like the actual, like, playing it, if you really break down the mechanics of it, probably not all that engaging or that cool, honestly. But the, like, everything surrounding it is so fucking hype that you can't not just get into it. It's so cool. Those parts are so cool. Like, so awesome. Titan stuff, so rad.
If you're just tuning in, Andrew loves this. Wholeheartedly loves this game.
That's just that section. He's been explaining why he'd give it a 10 out of 10 for the last 11 minutes.
No, I feel like Giacco is with Tears of the Kingdom. I am with 16.
I don't know. Well, Giacco, my understanding with your Tears of the Kingdom is you're like full on, like there's no redeeming moment to you, really.
I haven't hit a moment that makes me think like this is the coolest moment I've ever played in a video game. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Whereas like for you, Andrew, it seems like Final Fantasy 16 is like an abusive significant other.
I don't want to go that dark, but sure. It's definitely it's a paradox, man. I don't know. How does it exist? How do they do this cool stuff and then make so much really bad old school game design that's mm-hmm. like over 15 years old now? Like it's not good. A lot of the choices, like the quest design and the not open world but the levely, it's kind of open worldy stuff that's going on. Not great. Mm-hmm. They can get rid of that the upgrade paths. Well, there's no real path. What am I fucking talking about? You get a number go up on sword. That's it.
Yeah, that's the path. It's very linear. Yes. So one way to the end. Yeah. Well, anyway. I'm still on board to like I want to finish this game because I want to see the whole story. Yeah. Well, see the thing. I want to try to dissect what the story is about, but also I want to see whatever the final boss fight or fights are. Right.
The final fight, I can't wait for. It better live up. Because I was like, there's no way Titan's the peak because it's so rad and it's kind of relatively early. There's a lot of shit left. Mm-hmm. So
I want to chat about it with Stretch on a future pod for sure. But I think that
is doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, we'll find out. Maybe the ending is there's a big redemption, you know? But I think that's a wrap for this week's Tech Raptor podcast. Giacco, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank really you all for having
more
me.
Tabletop.
So fun.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your love of Zelda.
We're gonna, every time a new Zelda game comes out, we got to make sure to get Giacco
bring
on
me
here.
On, yeah. But bring me on, like, you know, you got to give me a month and a half.
Yeah, we'll give him 2 months after it comes out. Yeah.
Right. I'll be like, hey, you guys know the Zelda game?
Yeah.
But yeah, we hope you enjoyed the podcast. And if you did, please leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on, or throw a comment down below underneath, like here on YouTube or on our site, and let us know, are we wrong about Zelda and or Final Fantasy 16? Are our takes too hot and why? Yeah, no, Andrew? No? But yeah, let us know in the comments down below. If you want more of this, of Tech Raptor, we are always publishing news, features, reviews, etc. at techraptor.net, where we also do publish tabletop stuff. You can check out all of those things there. But if you want more of this show, we will be back in your feed next Monday, and we will see you then. Bye.